As I said before the break, I thought if we just had a look at a couple of areas that are fairly common that cross over, and then just move into the recovery process and what's involved, and how can people recover, and can they fully recover, and you know, what are the things that actually stop recovery. So we'll see if we can get through all that in an hour and have some time for questions. All right. Okay. I think one of the areas that I've seen coming up more and more again is actually the whole area of emotional hunger and lack of attachment as a child. And I very often find that people with eating disorders, you know, that's very significant. There are factors to be taken into consideration in terms of the type of person who develops an eating disorder. You may say, well, you know, this person has a sibling in the family, the sibling hasn't developed it, so why has this person developed it? So personality traits, some say genetics, all of those are contributory factors as well. But person's response and how they respond. Very often people are, those who develop eating disorders are quite intelligent, sensitive, creative people who take things very personally. You know, so our own interpretations and perceptions will affect how we respond to situations. But there is something I think is important about this whole area of emotional hunger, and probably, you know, all of us are emotionally hungry, spiritually hungry, to a degree. But the person with an eating disorder, I find that this lack of actual connection and attachment early on in childhood is significant. And what can so easily happen is that vacuum gets filled with a behavioural pattern, or it gets numbed, dulled, killed, destroyed, acted out, for all sorts of different reasons. And again, this is where I feel that a Christian approach is so vital, because we can't ever go back. You know, we can't put back in place what wasn't there. But this is where God can make the difference. And our attachment is actually needed, is that we attach to God. And in that place of security, learn to relate and receive healing for what wasn't received as a child. But very often what people do is they try to attach to another individual. So then there's loss, there's emptiness, there's being let down, there's hurt, there's abandonment, which just reinforces this whole emptiness. So I believe very strongly in a spiritual and an emotional answer to this area. So there's obviously a lot I could go on to say about that. But it's important, I think, in working with people with eating disorders to actually look at what attachments were made early on. You know, what are the basic insecurities that are there now? What are the whole belief systems that are going on in a person's mind? Well, I'll come to more of that in a minute. There's a need for love and nurture. There's a need for self-worth and security. And if those aren't met, aren't developed, then the eating disorder will start to take their place and we'll fill the vacuum. So is there anything that anybody wants to ask about that before I actually look at the recovery process? It's something that I've just really had to bring to your attention as opposed to being able to go over in detail. Yes? Yes. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I'll just sort of echo that for if anybody's listening to the tape, is, you know, is it based in early childhood, or can it be to do with the transition from childhood to adulthood and not having the tools? And the answer is, it's going to be different for different people. But very commonly, the transition from childhood to adulthood and not having the tools, I would say that is a very, very common one. For some people, there is going to be added to that, there is going to be the complexity of very early childhood issues as well. So, you know, no two people, again, are going to be exactly the same. But I think this thing from childhood to adulthood is actually a very big issue. And not having the tools to make that transition, either they're lacking or the people have been taught, you know, a wrong way of being, of moving from childhood to adulthood. People have misconceptions, people have fears about adulthood. You know, how am I going to cope? Some people have been overprotected and therefore they don't know how to protect themselves in adulthood. But all of those, I think, are significant issues, definitely. Yeah. Which is why I said, in terms of recovery, actually equipping people and teaching people is an essential part of the recovery process, of the healing process. And that's something, certainly when we hold courses at Nicholson, is we work strongly in building resources for, you know, helping the person to build physical, emotional and spiritual resources to cope. At the end of the day, only they can make the decision to make the transition out of an eating disorder. But if you don't have the tools, then that decision is going to be a very difficult, slippery decision to make. If my responsibility in helping people is to present the tools to them and to, I believe, you know, to motivate and encourage and build them up spiritually, to have the strength to then take those tools and use them. But I can't actually make them better, and no one can. Only that's between the person and God and the decisions that that individual makes. But the tools are essential. So I'll talk a little bit about the tools in a minute. First of all, what I would say is that there is a process often of recovery. That very rarely does a person have an eating disorder and then wake up the next day and say, I'm not going to have my eating disorder anymore. Never say never, because I did that at a seminar once and somebody said, well, I've done that. People never binge on salad. Well, I do. Somebody said, oh, there's always one, isn't there? So I'm not going to say that people don't wake up tomorrow and suddenly snap out of an eating disorder, because there's always going to be the one who does. But on the whole, people don't. And it is a process. And the process, it may go through different phases. The first phase may be, you know, this is my version of the situation. Actually, I'm not a compulsive eater because I eat this and this and this. But actually, what I'm telling you is what I eat when I sit down. And if I'm walking from one room to room, that doesn't count. And if I'm driving, that doesn't count. So, you know, there's my version of accounts. Then there's the honesty phase, which is, well, actually, I'm coming face to face with myself and saying, this is what I do. And this is how I am. And I am bulimic, or I am a compulsive eater. There's the discovering the causes phase, which is what we've really done this morning, is what's below the water's surface? You know, why? Okay, now I know how I am. Now I've been able to actually be honest with myself and hopefully with somebody else. Then why? Why am I like this? This is the phase that I was at when I started to write Puppet on a String. I began to face what I was doing with my eating. And in the writing, I was asking myself, why? Why am I doing this? What's going on? Then there's the separating food and feelings phase. I think this is very important, because people use food to handle feelings, to handle relationships in response. And there needs to be a separating. You know, I'm angry, or I'm hurting, I'm disappointed, and I binge. No, hang on a minute. I'm angry, I'm hurting, and I'm disappointed. Now, that is separate from food. Food is there for nutritional and, you know, pleasure, but it's there for nutritional purposes. And particularly for people who overeat, this is absolutely vital to separate out food and feelings. Otherwise, you just go round and round and round in a circle. Then there's the discovering new strategies. This is the life skills, the tools. Well, I've always turned to food when I'm upset. Right, so if I don't turn to food, what do you do with upset? What do you do with pain? What do you do with anger? Anybody ever been frightened to cry because they thought if they cried, they'd never stop? I've been in that place. Well, somebody said something to me once, and I found it to be the most helpful thing ever. Emotions are like waves. They reach a peak, and then they drop. Now, if you've ever cried alone at night, and it hurts so badly, you think, this is never going to end. To hold on to that concept, emotions are like a wave. They reach a peak, and they drop. Nobody has ever died from feelings. And just simple little things like that, those are some of the tools that are necessary. Another huge area, and I could spend an entire day on this, is boundaries. People with eating disorders usually have quite messed up boundaries. Not just in their eating, but in all areas. People invade them, so they have to set strict boundaries, they have to set, you know, they have to take rigid control, they push people away, they pull people in, people have abused them in different ways. And the whole area of boundaries, that's a skill that has to be developed, or they will go on being hurt in life. The abused person who goes on being abused, they do. The person that has been misunderstood goes on being misunderstood. The only way to stop those things from happening is to be able to develop skills, set boundaries, break the spiritual strongholds that are there in order to move away from those patterns and giving out the messages. The victim who remains a victim because she comes across as a victim. And so those that like to bully, bully. Those are the kind of things that need to be taught alongside the actual issues that are dealt with an eating disorder. So that's the discovering new strategies phase. And in that, actually, I'll touch on this a bit more in a minute, but in that can be the whole eating side of things. We teach different principles with regards to beginnings and endings of eating, what balances of food to eat to start so that you're less likely to binge. Those are all strategies that need to be learnt. Then there's the understanding but not changing phase. Now, somebody has raised this slightly. Is it possible to, you know, you have the knowledge but you don't change because you're still wanting to hold on to it? There's the payoff. You're still wanting to hold on to it. In the 90s, I did some counselling training in the States in the Minuth Meyer Clinic and went to a codependency group. And there was the group leader who was a therapist. There was me, and then there was all the people who were there because they'd got a codependency issue. And, you know, I thought, I didn't know much about codependency, and these people had so much knowledge. They weren't free. See, they were in the understanding but not changing phase. Actually, it was so great. They were so codependent. They bought me a flight ticket to somewhere. I was probably so codependent I accepted it. But it was great. But I think lots of us are in that phase in different areas of our lives, aren't we? We begin to understand why we do what we do, but we don't do anything about it. I love Romans 7 and 8. You know, the whole concept of, like, why do I do what I do? You know? Okay, then there's the holding on phase. Overcoming an eating disorder is a little bit like a grieving process. It's letting go. It's been somebody's best friend. They've had it there all the time. It's like, what do I do? What do I think? What do I feel? So there's a grieving process. So there is an actual holding on. The person is fully equipped. They've dealt with things. They know what to do. But they hold on to it. because it's familiar. And then there is the letting go. Then there is the surrender, the letting go phase. But then after that, there's actually the cementing change. You start to make new changes, but they have to be cemented and really worked out and worked into a person, and that then has to become familiar. And we can apply all of this, you know, in our Christian journey as well, can't we? As we grow with God. And the walking into freedom. And they're coming to the point where it's like, actually, there's no way I'd want to go back. There's no attraction. It doesn't hold anything for me. It's not going to do anything for me to be 4 stone underweight or 10 stone overweight. Or, you know, it's not actually going to do anything. So that's the real freedom phase. But the thought of recovery is quite scary. And I think before a person can even think about getting better, let alone what's involved in getting better, there is this whole thing of looking at the pros and cons. Do I want it? Don't I want it? And one of the things that we do fairly early on in the courses is look at the fears that people have in coming on a course, and then also the pros and cons of having the eating disorder. Let's face it, I say to people, let's face it, an eating disorder has advantages. It's not all bad, or you wouldn't have bothered with it in the first place. It has an advantage, so let's look at all the advantages that it has for you. And so people can list all the advantages that are there. Now, I want you to face the reality and actually look at the disadvantages. What is it actually, you know, in what way is it robbing you in life? What's it stopping you from doing? What don't you like about it? And so, you know, then on that list start to come things like job choice, relationship, freedom to go out for a meal with friends, the way people view me. Well, people always view me like I'm a child or I'm a victim. Well, yeah, because that's actually, in the anorexic state, how you're coming across. But somebody would say, well, I don't actually want that anymore. So let's look at all the disadvantages, all the ways in which it's hindering you, physically, emotionally, spiritually. Does it hinder you in your relationship with God? Well, yes, it does, because of my choices, because of the shield I bring down, the way I get rid of, my expectations. There are so many ways in which an eating disorder can affect a person physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So that's the first stage, is actually looking at the advantages and the disadvantages. Now, if there are 1,000,001 advantages and 1 disadvantage, the person's not going to be ready to get better. There has to come, maybe they're not actually facing reality at that point. But to actually receive help in terms of wanting to be free from the eating disorder with 1,000,000 advantages and 1 disadvantage would be hard work. And the ideal, really, in terms of getting better, is when the disadvantages start to equal and hopefully outweigh the advantages. Then there's the whole process of looking at, well, what is recovery and what is needed. This doesn't mean to say that somebody isn't going to be scared about recovery. They're still going to be in this double mind sometimes, of wanting and not wanting. I think it takes quite a long time to be out of that wanting and not wanting, because it's been their protection, it's been their way forward, it's been their survival mechanism. So why would they suddenly wake up tomorrow and not want it? People often come into a course and say, I really want to be free of my eating disorder. I said, okay, if I were to go up to you and just go like that and you were free, how would you feel? Scared. Okay, we need to look at the scared, because that's what's preventing you from getting better. It's so easy to say, I want to get better. Okay, what does getting better involve? Getting better means body image, relationship with food, normal eating, relationship with people, the way you handle your emotions. That's what getting better involves. It's not just the bit about the eating disorder I don't like going away. Getting better, you can't have a half better. So it's quite a challenge. Now, a lot of people don't ever make it to recovery. Statistics say that 50% of patients studied, or fewer than 50% of anorexic patient studies, actually recover. Which I think, you know, is shocking, really. But then I don't think it helps if you're told that you can't ever fully recover. In the early days of my anorexia, I remember both me and my parents being told that, you know, you don't expect her to ever fully recover. Well, if I thought I had to learn to live with anorexia, part of me wouldn't want to live. It wasn't life. It was an existence. And I would reinforce over and over again, don't expect anything less than full recovery. Don't expect perfection, but don't expect anything less than full recovery. You know, if the Son has come to set you free, he's come to set you free indeed. He's not come to set you free until you hit a difficult problem and then put you back into bondage again. He's not come to set you free from one aspect and not another aspect. So there are lots of things involved in recovery. One is our whole relationship with food, weight, being a fairly normal body weight. They say that a fairly normal body weight is between having a BMI of between about 20 and 25. Some of you will know what a BMI is and some of you won't. It's body mass index. It's your height times your weight, isn't it? Yes, that's your body mass index. Is it times or divided? I don't know, whatever. Anyway, you get your body mass index. And I don't know what my body mass index is. It's probably about 22, 3, I don't know. So anyway, your body mass index for a healthy weight is between 20 and 25. So if you're under that, you're underweight. If you're over, you're overweight. And then they have categories of severely overweight and obese. Recovery, I believe, involves a relatively normal body mass index. I remember in the very early days that I recovered and I'd written Puppet on a String and I went round speaking, and I remember somebody saying to me, oh, you can't be better because you're not very fat. You know, it's like, well, I thought if I was very fat, then I probably wouldn't be better because I'd have swum from one extreme to the other. But this sort of idea that, well, you can't be better because you're still slim. Yeah, but I'm within normal range. So then there's a life which is no longer centered around food. People can be better in terms of being a normal body weight, but their life is totally centered around food. They are obsessed. Have you ever met people who have never been diagnosed with an eating disorder, but you know they've got one simply by the way they relate to food? Flexibility in eating. Eating three meals a day, not eating three meals a day. Overeating when you go out with friends. Skipping lunch because you're in a hurry. And that not throwing you back into, oh, because I've skipped lunch, I think I'll skip dinner and then I'll skip breakfast. Or because I've overeaten last night, I'll starve the next day. Or because I've overeaten last night with these friends, that gives me an excuse to overeat for breakfast, lunch and dinner. See, that is freedom from an eating disorder, is to be able to have this flexibility in your eating and not be thrown back into a chaotic eating pattern or an addictive cycle. The return of bodily disturbances such as menstruation. The ability to express and process emotions as well as any of us do without actually attaching those to food. A move away from thinking errors. My book Beyond Chaotic Eating goes into a lot of the different thinking errors that occur. But I mentioned black and white thinking. That's one thinking error that occurs. So many thinking errors that occur. So, like, somebody's walked past me, I must have done something wrong. We've done that one, all of us, I'm sure. Establishing two-way adult relationships. Being able to hold down a job, emotional and physical separation from parents, ability to have fun and integrate different aspects of life. Not exchanging the eating disorder for another addiction. Those are the kind of things that you would look at in making a recovery. Now, it's worth having a look at those, because somebody who's suffering may look at that and think, oh, gosh, I don't want recovery. Actually, I want to stay where I am. And each one of us have the right to do that. But what I would say is that there will come a point in staying where you are that you'll realise that you don't have life. You merely have an existence. And there are disadvantages. So I would encourage you to keep looking at those and to keep going over them. So if I was helping somebody, what would be the areas that I would want to focus on? One, obviously, would be the physical. Eating disorders have a physical element to them. People lose weight, people gain weight. There are physical things happening to a person's body. When somebody binges and vomits, that is not the end of the story. There's often an electrolyte imbalance, other complications, puffy face, enamel on the teeth get damaged, throat problems. There are physical implications, hormonal problems for all eating disorders. So, you know, there are physical implications, so there needs to be a physical answer. Then there is the whole relationship with food. And again, I could spend an entire day on our relationship with food. But to put it very simply, if a lot of our relationship with food is to do with the mentality up here, and that is to do with society in which we live. And we live in a society that has dictated certain things around food. That's why eating disorders is a very high coping mechanism in this society. When I was working in rural Black Africa, no, you didn't get eating disorders. You do now because they're taking on Western thinking. But, for instance, if my thinking goes like this, I'm going to be good today. Right? What does that mean? That's a very funny thing to say, isn't it? I'm going to be good today. Tell me, what does it mean I'm going to be good today? I can see some people laughing over here. Somebody knows what I'm talking about. It means... It depends on what day it is. Usually means I'm not going to have X, Y, and Z, yeah? Like, I'm not going to have cake, I'm not going to have biscuits. Because, let's face it, what is a good food? Somebody tell me what a good food is. Okay, wholemeal bread, that's a man's answer, that's good, I like that, nice and healthy one. Come on, some of you ladies. Salad, yes. All right, somebody tell me what a bad food is then. Hang on, we won't have an argument in church. Another bad food?
Cake.
Right, come on, why are they bad? Who's called them bad? Good and bad, it's very funny, isn't it?
If you think... And
okay. In most people's logic, it's, you know, they're naughty. I mean, we really use the most ridiculous language, don't you? Don't we? You know, I'm going to be naughty. So once we talk about a bad food or a naughty food, when we eat that, we then talk about us being bad or naughty. And we do have this whole mentality of I shouldn't and I mustn't and I can't. And if I have that, it's going to put on weight. Nothing will put on weight if you eat it in proportion. And that's the whole concept. And that's why I also don't really believe in diets. Because, again, well, certain diets anyway, they educate you wrongly and then you have to readjust your eating afterwards. There is no good or bad food. There is no naughty or nice food. There are certain foods that are more useful in your body for different functions. There are certain foods that are less useful. There are certain foods that if you want to keep your body peak functioning, then you need to eat less of them. And that's just a fact. But you see, we get into this mentality of, I'll be good today, so I won't have breakfast. And then I'll try not to have any carbohydrate at lunch. And you set yourself up to binge in the evening. And those are the kind of patterns that people get into. And it sounds very simple, but that's how people quite often start out in an eating disorder. may be a little bit overweight, I'll cut that out, I'll do that. The reason they stay in an eating disorder is because there are deep-seated emotional issues and reasons to stay there. But a lot of people tamper with these things and it disappears. Some people, it then provides an answer to their life and they stay in it. To recover is to actually change our thinking about food and our whole attitude towards it, and to get rid of this black and white, naughty, nice, good, bad, to look at what is balanced eating. When our eating is out of balance, we're more likely to crave certain types of foods. You probably all know the difference between a complex and a simple carbohydrate. Complex carbohydrate releases energy slowly, like your wholemeal bread and jacket potatoes and whole wheat pasta and brown rice. And a simple carbohydrate, like sugar, releases energy quickly. Hence, if you're feeling a bit low, emotionally or physically, you go for sweet food. But you then get a crash very quickly afterwards. So there are very physical, practical things that can be done. And those are the things that we would work with people in order to recover. An eating disorder is physical and it needs a physical solution. When I was 16, I was very ill with anorexia in hospital, and the medics at the time, there was not much understanding. I was on a medical ward and the doctor said to my parents, "Don't care what she eats, as long as she eats. She can stuff her face on sweets all day." Now, if that had happened, I would have come out of hospital with bizarre eating patterns. Now, it's far more likely that I would then have gone into something like bulimia, with bizarre eating patterns, totally unresolved emotional issues. As it was, I didn't stuff my face on sweets, I didn't eat very much, and I came out still anorexic. But can you see that it actually, what a person eats is vital as to where their eating disorder then goes. So the whole nutritional aspect, and again, going to see a dietitian or nutritionist is actually quite important with somebody overcoming an eating disorder, particularly if it's fairly complex eating disorder. So that has to be worked through. The emotional aspect needs to be worked through. The anorexic numbs her feelings, she denies her needs, and she locks away trauma. The bulimic splits off her negative emotions. She admits she has needs very often, but she can't hold on to them, and she pushes away trauma. And the compulsive eater pushes down feelings, swallowing the fear, swallowing the anger, and then has a fear that this won't actually be met. And then she submerges trauma. So it's perfectly possible to get nutritional help and have better eating patterns, more helpful eating patterns, but with all this underneath, there's a volcano waiting to erupt. Instead, the person's going to need to gain an accurate understanding of the role that emotions play. What are emotions? They're funny things, they're weird things, but I look at them as a bit like red flags. They sort of pop up to tell us something. And it would pop up and say, like, say, anger. Suddenly feel anger. Well, there's a reason for that. Now, if it's a certain level of anger, people often say that behind anger is a blocked goal. If my goal was to, or Genevieve's goal was to hold this seminar in here, and somebody hadn't handed over the keys and we had no access into the church, you may start to feel a bit angry. So if the anger then isn't processed, but it's just pushed down, you imagine year after year, situation after situation, it becomes expressed through the body, eating patterns, control. A person needs to learn what an emotion is, why it's there, what it's telling them, and what to do with it. So they need to develop a means of actually dealing with those emotions, maybe have therapy counselling for more complex situations like trauma and self-destructive patterns, and address the roots of persistent, repetitive, negative emotions, gain an accurate understanding of the role that those play in life. And I can think of, you know, so many different situations where people were completely stuck in their eating disorder, not moving forward at all because they were simply looking at the pattern of the eating disorder and not actually looking at why it was there emotionally and what was lacking in their life emotionally. So again, there's a lot that I could go through on the emotions. But in conjunction with that, one of the areas that I'd like to leave you with to think through quite deeply is the whole area of correcting thinking. I personally believe that there's a lot of distorted thinking behind eating disorders, which also links very strongly into the emotional area. I just mentioned a simple little thing, where somebody walks past and you say, "What have I done wrong?" Now, on the courses that we run, we work quite strongly at actually correcting a person's thinking, because those roots, you know, they have roots, that kind of thinking, "What have I done wrong?" usually has a history of, say, consistently being told off or never being able to do the right thing, being misunderstood by people. So there's an automatic thinking that becomes ingrained, that the minute somebody walks past and doesn't acknowledge you, it's got to be your fault. And then attached to that come all the emotions, and then the response to the emotions becomes all the eating disorder patterns. And this vicious cycle starts to happen. So unravelling that cycle is to go back to the thinking process. As some of you will know of a psychologist, Albert Ellis, who talked about the ABC theory of emotion. He said A being the activating event, B being the belief system, and C the consequent emotion. And he said we don't go AC in life. We think we do, but we don't. In other words, something doesn't happen and we feel like this. Otherwise, we could never change our circumstance, never change our emotions. He said something happens in between, and that's B, and that's our belief system. So an event occurs, we interpret that event, and then we feel an emotion. And it's that interpretation that is so vital. Looking at, is that interpretation accurate? And with a lot of people with eating disorders, the answer is no, those interpretations are very inaccurate. And they are based on past experiences. They are based on beliefs that have built up over years. They're based on negative things that people have said over the years, which is where you get a lot of lack of self-confidence, low self-worth. The same applies in this area. And it's also been said, how it was measured, I don't know, but one psychologist said that we speak to ourselves. Anybody speak to themselves? We do. We all do, inside our heads. Some of us speak outside as well, but we speak to ourselves at a rate of 1,300 words a minute. Now, a negative comment, negative word, results in a negative emotion. So if we speak to ourselves at a rate of 1,300 words a minute negatively, and negative self-talk results in negative emotions, I wonder, do you think we might feel bright and breezy that day? We don't. And it's actually incredibly powerful. And I, this is in psychology, but I personally believe that actually, this is a scriptural principle, isn't it? in terms of correcting our thinking. Thanks. Okay, it's a scriptural principle. It's, you know, there's nothing new under the sun. It is a biblical principle. And we need to actually correct the thinking that is going on. And what I would encourage people to do is actually correct it and to bring it in line with biblical thinking and truth and scriptural principles. Because what do you correct it to otherwise? There's nothing to... It's a bit like shifting sand. If I correct my thinking to something else, that might change. If I base my security on a relationship with an individual, that relationship might change. That person may die. And so we work quite strongly with helping people to correct their thinking, but to correct it in line with biblical principles and biblical teaching. And obviously within that comes the whole thing of relationship with God and where does a person stand with God. I'm just going to give you a couple of common irrational beliefs that exist. See, I don't know if anybody can relate to these. I must be liked or accepted by every person or every important person in my life for almost everything I do. I must be successful, competent, and achieving in everything I do if I'm to consider myself worthwhile. It is awful and terrible when things are not the way I would like them to be. Things should be different. I must feel anxious, upset, and preoccupied if something is or may be dangerous. Human unhappiness is caused by events beyond our control, so people have little or no ability to control their negative feelings. It is easier to avoid facing many of life's difficulties and responsibilities than to face them. When people act badly, inadequately, or unfairly, I blame them and view them as completely bad or pathetic, including myself. Maximum happiness can be achieved by inertia and inaction or by passively enjoying oneself. Everyone should be dependent on others, and I need someone stronger than myself on whom I can rely. Okay, we could go on and on, but it's a lot of it is all or nothing thinking. What's called awfulizing, catastrophizing, personalizing, negative focus, jumping to conclusions. I'm really good at that one. Do you ever jump to conclusions? I've worked it out way before, you know. I think. So it wasn't like that then? No. Are you sure? You didn't think that? No. You know, and we really get ourselves into a lot of difficulty. Well, those are the kind of things that need to change. And it's helpful to actually, for the person to ask things like, am I thinking in all or nothing terms? Am I condemning myself as a total person? Am I concentrating on my weakness and forgetting my strength? Am I blaming myself for something which is not my fault? Do I have a double standard? Am I exaggerating the importance of events? Am I assuming that I can do nothing to change a situation? I don't believe that without thinking corrected, it's actually quite difficult to recover from an eating disorder. And tied in with that is the whole sense of identity, security, self-worth, and value as an individual. I talked about identity at the beginning. It's very difficult, I think, to recover from an eating disorder without a strong sense of identity and value. What is your identity? It becomes the eating disorder, but without the eating disorder, what is your identity? What is your worth and your value as an individual? Is it work? Is it fashion? Is your value dependent on other people? And you being mirrored by other people, or mirroring yourself against other people? Is your value dependent on achievement and success? For me, I know that the only thing that has actually brought security in terms of value and worth has actually been my relationship with God. When I was 19, I gave my life to Christ, and it was not a simple just do it thing. I've always been a very deep thinker, and I went to a Christian youth camp to basically help with cooking. I didn't go to the camp. And when I was there, I heard the gospel spelled out in a way that I could understand. And I heard, you know, a very clear, strong message about the gospel, that there is a God, that he had a son, Jesus, and that Jesus died to pay the price for our sins, because that's the way in which we could be accepted and worthy to this holy God. So naturally, we're all unworthy because of the fall. And the only way back into that relationship was through this relationship with Jesus. And I've probably heard it before that, but it was the way it was explained, something went click inside. And I was hungry for security. And I was hungry for answers out of my eating disorder. And I was hungry for life, not just existence. And it was like a flash. It suddenly all made sense. But I had in my hands, these two things. This way or my way. And do you know, I all night I wrestled with this. Because I thought, if I let go of my way, what if this God over here is a control freak and totally controls me, and everything he wants, because it's bound to be like that, you know, everything he wants isn't what I want. But, you know, something inside me, which I believe was the Holy Spirit, something inside me was saying, it's not like that. Just trust me, it's not like that. And I had to really battle, do I stay with this anorexia? Do I stay with his mindset? Do I stay trying to do it on my own? But there's something different over here. And there's something different about the people that were around me. And so I got to the point, after wrestling all night, is at the end of the day, only I could make a choice. And I made the choice. I recognized exactly what had been spoken about. And I made the choice, and I said, I do accept that Jesus is the Son of God. I do accept that he has died for me. And I want to follow him. And do you know, that was the first time in my life that, despite all the things that had gone on, and I was still in a very difficult situation in my life at that time, all the things that had gone on, that was the first time that I actually felt loved. And I felt worth, and I felt value, and I felt security. No, my problems didn't disappear. Oh, I had a mountain of things to sort out after that. But there was like this solid platform. There was this connection. There was this relationship. The empty bit in here was no longer empty. Yes, I was still depressed at times. I was still lonely. I still hurt. I still had all the traumas of my past to deal with. But there was this security that didn't exist before. And in that place of security, I could then begin to look at, why did the anorexia come on board? What's the relationship with my parents like? What's the relationship with my sister like? What went on at boarding school? What did it mean to be abused? What, you know, what's all my distorted thinking? Yes, it was still important for me to achieve. Yes, I was still a perfectionist, but if it all came crashing around, I knew, if everything fell away, I knew that I'd have that relationship that would never fall away. And to me, that was the absolute turning point in recovery. I then had to learn to have healthy relationship with food and eat normal meals. I then had to learn to deal with emotions and things like anger that I hated, and that took donkey's years, to set boundaries, and stumbled and fell and did lots of things that were
unhelpful and unproductive in the learning process. But my identity, nothing could steal it. My identity as a child of God, it's like nothing could take it away. Nothing. I could discover all sorts of things about my uniqueness and individuality. I'm creative and I'm this and I'm that and I'm sensitive. But my actual centre couldn't, wouldn't and won't ever change. And that's actually an incredible thing to have available to us all. But it's absolutely amazing. So that's really the essence of the work that we do with eating disorder people now, is to actually look at, you know, where is your security, your self-worth, your value coming from? And once that is secure, then actually looking at what else is involved in the whole recovery process. So that when you're battling through traumas, when you're battling through attitudes and feelings, when you're battling through body image, you've actually got a secure foundation upon which to battle. So that's it in an essence. I mean, I could talk all day on that, but we've got about 10 or 15 minutes, and I can cover something else in more depth if you want me to, but I'm keen if there are any particular questions that you want to ask or anything that you want me to address, or any stories or case histories or any more about the work that we do, then it'd be good just to have that time now. Yes, somebody at the back wants to. How do you be a good friend? Yes, obviously prayer. Not giving up on the person, but getting the balance between love and boundaries. It'll hurt people for me to say it, and I didn't like it at the time, but people with eating disorders can be very manipulative. And there's a lot of reasons as to why that is the case. Anybody with an addiction is manipulative, because you have to be to maintain your addiction. So to get that balance between love and boundaries, between being kind but being firm, is really important. And in the church, we've sometimes swung too far on the love side, and people have actually got away with things that in the end have been destructive to them, let alone anybody else. Other people swing too far on the boundary side, and so it's all restriction and no love and value for the individual. And it's getting that balance between the two. So it's walking, not giving up, but equally not allowing yourself to be walked over. Setting some boundaries, setting conditions sometimes. And that does mean, James Dobson's book, Tough Love, it does actually require... I believe biblical love is actually quite tough love. It's not a soft... but, I mean, as a friend, the other thing I would say is learn as much as you can, so that put yourself in the other person's shoes. Try to help the person have as balanced a life as possible, so that the life isn't just focused around the eating disorder. Keep pushing them that little bit more. Say, okay, you just push through that little bit more. Don't let them stay in a comfortable place all the time. Any other questions? Yeah.
Could you explain a little bit about how self-harm fits
in? Sure, self-harm. It's a fair number of people with eating disorders have issues with self-harm, and obviously some people who don't have eating disorders have issues with self-harm. It can take, all sorts of different forms. Anything from cutting, bruising, purposely injuring, or shutting your arm in a door, being in a cold place, scratching, lots of different forms of self-harm, overdoses, many different ways of harming yourself. And there are different reasons as to why people do self-harm. Some of the common ones are that a person can quite often be like in a numb place, and it releases emotion. So the emotion is in there, and it actually releases that emotion. It can enable a person to get from one emotional state to another. So if somebody is angry or they're in pain and they need to get to the, you know, opposite extreme of emotion, then self-harm can enable them to move from one emotion to the other. It can be a response to self-loathing and self-hatred. Again, it's addictive. There can also be this sense of, if I can see blood, then that's the reality of I am hurting. I can't feel that I'm hurting. And if I see a wound, then that's the reality on the outside that I'm actually hurting on the inside. So there are, you know, lots of reasons as to why it's there. It's very rarely as simple as somebody, you know, self-seeking or self-attention. It's very rarely that simple. If it is about attention, then why is there need for attention? You know, if you're secure as a person, you don't actually need attention. But one other thing that I would say that's very important, tied in with that and tied in with eating disorders, is learning the whole process of self-validation. We all, you know, we look to other people to validate ourselves. And one of the best gifts that we can give ourselves is to actually validate ourselves. So, for instance, let me give you an example. If I say, well, do you think I look nice? Or do you think this? Or do you think that? Or do you think it's okay if I do so and so? Yes, of course we need to check things out. But the bottom line is, I need to know that for myself. Because unless I know it for myself, I will be very insecure and I'll be constantly looking to other people. And when people then let us down, we have a huge emotional reaction. So really, the best gift that we can give ourselves is our security, really, in our relationship with God, and our security in our relationship with ourselves, because of our relationship with God, I think. And that enables us to be secure in our relationship with other people. But if we're constantly looking to other people to validate ourselves, then if you've got a problem in the middle of the night, what do you do? The ideal is that you're able to validate and have the security in your relationship with God in such a way that, 3 o'clock in the morning, that's still there, isn't it? Sounds simple, but it isn't. Any other? Oh, somebody, yes. 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 I would imagine, yes, I think they are actually. I mean, that's just something that I've discovered. I've not necessarily sort of read that or but it's certainly something that I've seen in the number of people that, you know, have come along my path. In which case, yes, the recovery process would be different. Not necessarily easier, one for one or the other. Sometimes when it's an image-based things, it can be harder because that concept, the mindset, has got to change. When it's trauma-based, sometimes when the trauma is dealt with, so is the eating disorder. So, you know, it's not that one is easier or one is more difficult, but in both cases, there will be mindset change that needs to take place. But probably different scripts within the mind that are going on, you know, different tapes that are being played. And probably coming alongside that is letting go of the perfection of image, you know, in trying to attain the perfect image. And letting go of perfection in other areas as well, and being willing to get to that point of being content. I love that passage of scripture where Paul says, you know, content in all circumstances. I think, if only, you know. But it's so fantastic just to be content in all circumstances. Lovely. Yes.
It may be with the rise of media that this whole area is getting more publicity. Mm. Get the impression it's a growing problem.
Yeah.
And thinking with the next generation, I'm sure most of us at presently are aware of people and have privilege of being alongside people where this is an issue.
Mm-hmm.
But for the next generation, is there anything that you would suggest we can do or to be carefully mindful of to help them before it becomes a problem?
Yeah, I think to help people before it becomes a problem is teach good life skills and a lot of it, I think, is about relationships. And I guess we probably are going to have big problems in the next generation because there's a lot of independence, isn't there? I mean, a lot of... I don't think there's ever been a time in society where so many people have lived on their own, where there's lack of community. So you don't get this feeding back to each other. So I just wonder, is that actually going to cause problems? The isolation and the independence and independent living. Yeah, so probably education more than anything else. Same goes with eating patterns. You know, the type of foods that people are eating is going to cause massive problems in the next generation. So we need to be mindful of exampling to others. You know, they don't have very good role models, I think, children. Sadly. Any other questions? Yes. Good question. I think from a non-Christian in terms of recovery, I mean, a lot of the things that I've spoken about, things like life skills, etc., that, you know, that isn't going to be different. It's your security, worth and value that is significantly different in terms of where that is placed. And the person would have to find that, I guess, in their relationship with themselves, in their relationship with society or another. Personally, I, you know, obviously think there's more to life than just that. But that's why I say that Christians haven't, you know, got... It's not just Christians that can recover. But I do believe it is a slightly different recovery. So it is, again, it's building relationship. But you are having to rely on an unpredictable response, an unpredictable person. Certainly, you know, building up those same boundaries and communication and life skills, healthy relationship with food, all of that can be done, you know, whether it's Christian or not Christian. So it is really just the foundational worth and value, which is going to have to be placed elsewhere. Mm. Yes.
How would you encourage, say, someone has met good reasons?
Yeah.
And they want to help you, that for whatever reason, say, not the opposite sex, there's so much they can do that they can just be two parents or something.
Yeah. Yeah, probably encouraging their friends or, you know, to learn as much as they can about what's really going on. So the person with the eating disorder, if they're willing to read a book themselves perhaps and then pass it on and say, this is how I feel, or this is what's going on, or you as a friend of a friend could encourage people to learn and understand, because understanding, you don't have to supply an answer. It's actually coming alongside and walking and being with an individual that's so important. Really, the answers need to come from the individual themselves, and if they then choose to seek some formal type of help, like therapy, in that context. But being a friend is actually understanding and endeavouring to do things that help rather than hinder. And you're only going to do that by you and other friends reading material and gaining an insight. So I would always go back to the person with the eating disorder and encourage them to encourage their friends. And I think, yeah, if you're talking about a girl who's got an eating disorder and male and female friends, there are going to be some things that obviously only the female friends can provide or can provide more easily for the sufferer, female sufferer. So encouraging other people to get involved as well is really good. What you don't want to do is have a dependence, like obviously you're trying to avoid, which is really good, a dependence and or an exclusive, you know, this is the only person who listens to me. But equally, you don't want to encourage a situation where somebody has no accountability because they're just depositing their troubles a bit here and a bit there and a bit here. So sometimes you have to actually work together as a collective to help somebody because they're not helping themselves because they're drawing on too many people. I don't know if that makes sense to you. I know it'll make sense to one or two people, but... Yes. Yes. How much is medical help needed? Well, I would say it obviously does depend on the person and on the situation and how physically unwell they are, in which case medical intervention I think is necessary. And unfortunately it does depend on where you live as to the type of, you know, medical intervention received. And some people who've been through hospital regimes would say it was less helpful than helpful. Others would say, you know, it saved my life. So you need to assess whether this is a medical necessity, in which case, helpful or unhelpful, it's necessary. I would rarely say that it solved the problem. Say that it perhaps got a person out of a tricky situation, but needs to be followed up by good spiritual and emotional input. When a person's weight drops below a certain level or their nutritional level drops below a certain level, their thinking becomes so impaired that the sort of therapeutic input becomes very difficult, in which case if they're not able to gain weight at home, then it's more beneficial, if they want to carry on with therapy, it's more beneficial that they go into hospital for a certain amount of refeeding. So it's very difficult to judge, you know, when and when not. And people can be resistant because when you get a chronic situation, people have been in and out of hospital, had treatment that has been disturbing to them, so there can be a resistance to go back in again. I remember working with one girl who I knew she had to go in. You know, I just saw the way she was climbing the stairs and I knew she had to, but there was just this utter resistance. And in the end, it did have to come down to, you know, we can't progress unless. And she did. She did go in. And, I mean, she's now actually recovered. The medics having said that, you know, she would certainly never recover. So it's a difficult one to work out. So I don't know whether that answers your question or not. Yes.
So you're offering residential courses.
Yes. They're 5 days. People come on a Monday and they go on a Friday. And in that period of time, we go through physical, emotional, spiritual teaching, prayer ministry, chance to talk one-to-one. We usually do some artwork. So at the moment, the ones we do are Monday to Friday. Yeah. Yeah. No, she wouldn't need to book it. I mean, it does vary from, you know, one course suddenly books up just like that, and then another doesn't. But no, I mean, it's not going to be a year in advance. I suspect that the October one's going to fill up quite quickly. The March one filled up really quickly. The May one's a bit slower because we opened it up to younger people with a parent, and I think maybe that's put some people off. but you know, you live and learn, don't you? I mean. The trouble is, because of the Children Act, you know, under 16s still need help, but you're restricted as to what you can do. So, but no, I mean, if they booked up and there was a waiting list, then I might negotiate with the house to put on another. But time can sometimes, you know, the house gets busy at different times of year.
Thank you so much, Helen. Okay. It's been so illuminating and helpful. And it's such a tender area, and you've handled it so expertly and sensitively. Thank you very much.